ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
For decades, low-income and minority communities across the United States were intentionally cut off from lending and investment through a system known as redlining. The practice, started in the 1930s, lasted for decades before being declared illegal. But the impact of redlining remains today, as many neighborhoods across the country suffer not only from reduced wealth and greater poverty, but from lower life expectancy and even higher incidences of chronic diseases. On this edition of UWM Today, we're talking with two UWM researchers involved in major studies that show how that legacy of redlining, which started 80 years ago, is still seen today in many of Milwaukee's poorest neighborhoods. Our guest are Helen Meyer, assistant professor in UWM's Zilber School of Public Health, and Emily Lynch, an alumni of the Zilber School who partnered with Helen on the redlining research. Welcome. Good to have both of you with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us, Tom. It's great to be here.
Helen, let's talk about the legacy of redlining. It really was insidious, wasn't it? The way in which years ago, people made deliberate efforts to, frankly, change the way in which life unfolded in neighborhoods in many of our large cities.
Yeah, so redlining is a term that describes the discriminatory practices of denying minority populations access to equal loan and housing opportunities. And one organization that was leading in redlining was the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC. And they are a government-sponsored entity that between 1935 and 1940 created residential security maps of over 200 cities across the United States. And these color-coded maps depicted the level of perceived desirability and investment risk of neighborhoods. And through this organization, it really pioneered the institutional logic of redlining. So when you hear that term redlining, that's where it originated from, because literally there's color-coded maps where red is representing the highest investment risk. By grading these neighborhoods in such a way, it really changed the investment possibilities in these neighborhoods, which then impacted home values in that area, as well as the tax base then. And when we have schools that are funded from property taxes, then you have schools with less funding, and then that leads to worse education outcomes for those neighborhoods. So you can really see how this act of redlining from over 80 years ago has impacted our neighborhoods in Milwaukee and in cities across the country today.
I want to talk more about the impact that we still see in our cities today, but I want to stay with the history for just a minute. What in the world possessed people back then, planners, to say that this was in the national interest to create these zones that were identified as no-go places, if you will, when it came to banks and insurance companies and the like? I mean, it seems counterintuitive at a time when the country was going through some serious economic problems back in the 30s that they would want to do anything to discourage growth.
Well, it was really a way to characterize mortgage lending risk, right? So HOLC had field agents that collected data on neighborhood conditions, housing, demographic characteristics, and local real estate factors that informed their neighborhood grades. And what's really fascinating, and I encourage anyone listening to the University of Richmond has digitized the original field notes. And you can go in and see the assessments of these field agents of these different neighborhoods. And, you know, to no surprise that they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-immigrant, and they're racist. And so it's, you know, it was a way, post-Depression to help banks determine which areas in cities were ripe for investment and which areas were going to be declining and at higher risk. So people made determinations that have affected neighborhoods for many years since.
What do we see here in Wisconsin? What communities were redlined?
So you can actually look at a map that, again, has been digitized, and it's on the University of Richmond's Mapping Inequality website. And so you can see areas around kind of the inner city, Walker's Point, so south part of the city, as well as parts in the north, and that would be in northwest versus, you see the green areas, which you would expect with what you see today was the North Shore.
So the redlining extended into the suburbs. It wasn't just in the city of Milwaukee.
So it's interesting because you have to think about what the city boundaries were in the 1930s, and that's very different than maybe what we consider the city boundaries today and the bleed into the suburbs. And so you can see that if you look at the map, you can see that there's, you know, by the downtown area, there's a little bit of a ring of redlining in certain areas. I believe also like Brewers Hill was redlined. And then going out into the northwest a little bit was also still risky mortgage grades. And then, yes, some of the suburbs also are included in the grading as well.
Yeah. So let's talk about the research that you and Emily worked on that went back both to the historic roots of redlining and now looking at the impact today. How did the research project get started and what exactly were you looking at?
So Emily Lynch was my fantastic graduate research assistant, and she is not only a phenomenal analyst, but a wonderful epidemiologist. And this work really started out of looking at some of the other socioeconomic indicators and health outcomes related to lead exposure in children. In doing that work, we stumbled across this historic redlining map and operationalized it for research. So I actually would love to turn it over to Emily to kind of talk about how she conducted this analysis.
So Emily, what did you do with all this data?
Yeah, great question. So, we started looking at this Hulk residential security map, and we really wanted to be able to come up with a way to empirically measure what we know as kind of a measure of structural racism, the way that redlining was conducted in the 1930s. And so what we did is we wanted to overlay the historic redlining map created in the 1930s with what our neighborhoods currently look like today. And so we did that by overlaying the redlining map with 2010 census tract boundaries, and we were able to calculate what we call a historic redlining score. And that assessed the degree of redlining that each census tract or neighborhood in Milwaukee was subject to. And so we were able to create a weighted score that was calculated from the proportion of Hulk residential security grades within the census tract boundary. And so this allowed us to kind of empirically measure the legacy of this redlining score on not only current neighborhood lending, but also health outcomes, to kind of look at this legacy over time and empirically measure this measure of structural racism.
So how did you get access to data like bank information, for example? One of the outcomes of redlining, as you indicated earlier, is that institutions are less likely to lend money. Did you go in and take a look at tax records, or how did you determine that this inequity still exists?
Yeah, so we works with a organization called the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, NCRC, and they directed us to Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data. This is also referenced as HMDA data. And HMDA was actually enacted in Congress in 1975 and is currently overseen by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and requires institutions to maintain, report, and disclose loan-level data. So this allowed us to look at the legacy of these areas that were historically redlined in relation to current home lending purchases. And so with their help, we were able to look at low lending occurrence in neighborhoods as well as high-cost loans.
So this question for either you or for Helen, since you have access to this data, although redlining has been declared illegal, do you have any evidence that the practice is still being done, that we still have people taking advantage of the information that they have about the economic status of a neighborhood?
I guess we don't have any explicit evidence on the, you know, what is in someone's head when they're issuing a loan or not. However, in looking at this HMDA data, we saw really stark disparities in lending occurrence and in the So the issue with lending is it's access to capital in the first place, right? So are loans being issued? And then number two, if they're being issued, are they high cost or predatory loans, or are they more regular loans? And so we had to look at both, because some census tracts in Milwaukee have less than five originated loans per 1,000 family homes. So very, very small amount of loans happening in an entire calendar year in some neighborhoods in Milwaukee. And so we see low loan occurrence, so lack of access to capital, as well as a higher prevalence of predatory loans in neighborhoods in Milwaukee.
So we've been talking so far about the financial impact that redlining has had. Let's talk about the social impact, the impact on people's well-being, their health. What have you found in your research that demonstrates the negative impact that redlining has had on people themselves?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, we do know that home ownership is one of the most common ways to build wealth in America, and is a contributing factor to the racial wealth gap that persists today. And we know that owning your own home, having access to economic resources and wealth, impacts the ability to access health-promoting resources, live in neighborhoods that have health-promoting infrastructure. So neighborhoods that have quality education, employment, healthcare, neighborhoods that aren't located near environmental hazards and pollutants. And we know that these conditions in which you live impact your health. And so not only does restricting access to home ownership to communities of color impact the persistent disinvestment in these neighborhoods, but we know that these low property values are reinforcing unequal distribution of resources that impact your health, because we know the conditions in which people live really shape the opportunities and health promoting resources that are accessible to people.
So Helen, as you take a look at the population in these areas that were redlined here in Milwaukee, can you quantify the way in which health is worse if you're living on that side of the tracks, if you will,
sure,
than here?
Yeah. So what we did was we pulled health indicator data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC's 500 Cities Project. And so they have estimates on the prevalence of poor physical health and poor mental health. And so our research showed that historic redlining score, so higher historic redlining scores, so tracts that were more likely to be redlined, also had higher average neighborhood prevalence of poor physical health and poor mental health.
And of course, at the end of the day, that has long-term effects. It's not just how healthy a person living in that neighborhood is today, but their kids, I presume, are in the same boat as the adults are in terms of being stuck in this environment, right?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of research out there trying to understand the intergenerational transmission of health disparities. And so redlining and being in areas that are currently discriminated against as well in mortgage lending definitely could be one way in which we're seeing the perpetuation of health disparities from one generation to the next.
Do people who live in the neighborhoods realize that they're victims of redlining?
I'm not sure. I don't know. It's possible. I don't know how widely spread these redlining maps are available out in the community. But I do think that it's something that I know Data You Can Use, which is a nonprofit here in Milwaukee focused on the democratization of data. I know that they do have the redlining map up on their website. So this is definitely information that the community should be aware of.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in our remote studios today in this COVID age are Helen Meyer. She's an assistant professor at UWM Zilber School of Public Health, and Emily Lynch, a former student of Helen, who is now an alumni of the school and currently working as a fellow at the Population Health Service Center at the UW-Madison campus. Both of them were involved in important research looking at the impact that redlining has had on life here in Milwaukee and in hundreds of other communities around the country. And Helen, I'd like to pick up on that note. Do we know whether or not redlining here in Milwaukee was any worse or more harmful than it was in other cities?
So as part of a national study and to further our collaboration with NCRC, we looked at a historic redlining score and various health outcomes in a national report. So we looked at it in cities, over 150 cities across the United States. And while some cities have different things pop out potentially as worse in terms of like shorter life expectancy associated with greater redlining than others. In general, you see these national trends that the worse redlining is associated with the poorest neighborhood health, the shortest life expectancy, the greatest social vulnerability, which is a Center for Disease Control and Prevention index on vulnerability to disasters such as a pandemic or a hurricane or uncontrollable wildfires. And so you in our city, in our study, as well as in cities across the nation with these where Hulk did these maps and redlined communities, we see a consistent message.
Emily, as a student working under the direction of Helen, what were your feelings as you began to see the result of these decisions that were made years ago? You're a young person, obviously, not around when any of these decisions were made. Was this depressing to you as you looked at the result of these political decisions done back in the 30s?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. I think, unfortunately, the health inequities that we're seeing today are painfully predictable. I know, we're living in the middle of a COVID pandemic and has definitely revealed many existing inequities in economic and health outcomes that have existed for a long time, and they've kind of continued to manifest themselves. And I think it was drastic, though, to really see the legacy of being able to empirically measure these maps and trace them so directly to health outcomes today. I think I knew these things conceptually, but to really see them in the numbers, to see the differences, in life expectancy when we partnered with NCRC on the national study, was really, really drastic. And the persistence of these inequities that kind of continue to manifest, unfortunately, are becoming more predictable and continuing to manifest in new ways, particularly amid the COVID pandemic. We're seeing that as well.
Both of you were working, as you mentioned before, with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition that helped facilitate the research. Is there any sense of how that national organization will take advantage of these findings? Is it likely this will lead to policy changes, either at the local or national level?
We hope so. I think that you cannot, especially in a pandemic and what we're seeing in terms of the health disparities with people of color and minorities experiencing greater risk of COVID infection and severity of disease and death, we're never going to fix these health disparities until we address the structural racism that has manifested in our vulnerability to a pandemic and poor health. And so, you know, while we're focused on redlining is a housing policy and an economic policy in terms of lending, you know, we have to think about that this is just one form of structural racism, right? And so to address the housing inequities and that form of structural racism and redlining, you know, we have to employ equity-focused policies that are dismantling and repairing the legacies of structural racism in the housing market. And I think to do that and to understand what exact kind of policies would be needed to address this, you know, first we have to show that this is still an issue. And so that's really the goal of this research, is to shed light on that. You know, there's tracks in our city in Milwaukee of which there are less than five loans originated per 1,000 homes, which is just ridiculous. So we're hoping that this work is a way to provide evidence that there needs to be equity-focused policies to dismantle and repair the legacy of structural racism in the housing market. But in reality, that's only one piece of the puzzle, and we have to look at other areas as well.
Over the years, over the last 20 years, we've seen the redevelopment, a lot of the neighborhoods, including the Walker's Point area, which you indicated earlier, Helen, was included in those red line districts. What's your sense in terms of how the gentrification of these older neighborhoods might help address those issues around racism that you're talking about, or does it help the wrong people? are we helping the people who have been most negatively impacted by redlining?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really complicated issue, and it's a really good question. And I think any policy that we implement, we have to think about how it's going to influence, like, is it going to achieve what we want to achieve, or is it going to widen existing disparities? And one way that we tried to understand kind of trajectory of discrimination over time is we looked at a trajectory variable of areas that were redlined or not versus the current lending discrimination or not. And so through that, we were able to classify tracks as having sustained disinvestment, being disinvested, so they were not redlined, but now are currently experiencing lending discrimination, gentrification areas, so they were redlined, but now are not having those loan discrimination, and then high investment, so areas that were not redlined and then are not having any current lending discrimination. And so we were able to kind of look at those at that trajectory over 80 years and current health outcomes. And you do see kind of a trend where, you know, as you would expect, the areas with sustained disinvestment had the worst health outcomes, and the high investment had the best health outcomes, and a nice trend among those categories. So, it does say, like, if we can invest, because we did see better health outcomes in those gentrified areas, that, you know, we can improve health. But again, it needs to be done in a way that does not marginalize existing residents and or widen disparities.
We just have a few minutes left, but I'm really interested in both of you answering this question. How will the work that you've done around redlining impact your future research? Helen, you're a study or practice of social epidemiology, looking at ways in which the social economic factors help or hurt our health. Has redlining study changed your opinion in terms of where you want to focus your work?
It's just, you know, one more piece of my projection, or my trajectory. But I think the next step for this work is to look at redlining and environmental exposures. So thinking about like brownfield sites and Superfund sites, distance to major roadways as a proxy for air pollution exposure, as well as, you know, we're looking here at neighborhood health outcomes. And so I think the logical next step is to think about how neighborhood redlining has influenced individual health outcomes. So connecting it to an individual data source.
And Emily, how about you? You're young in your career. You're, again, working as a fellow at the Population Health Service Center in UW-Madison. How has this research impacted what you're going to do with your life?
Yeah, you know, I think that I have the opportunity to work on various different projects and programs on racial health inequities. And I think having this background of understanding the way structural racism manifests in so many different ways really helps me understand what these racial inequities are rooted in, right? They're rooted in all of the different ways that structural racism is impacting neighborhoods and individuals in our country. And so when we think about racial health inequities, really naming the root cause of that is structural racism. And I think that's really important in the work that I'm doing now. And this study kind of helps really understand that perspective and understand root causes of health inequities.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to share your thoughts on what I think is really, really important research, and wish you both the best as you continue your own path looking into how we can create a better society. And I know that's one of the goals of public health, right? To make sure that we move the ball down the field and 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, we're looking at a better picture than the one that sadly we see in front of us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Helen Meyer, assistant professor, and Emily Lynch, an alumni of the UWM Silber School of Public Health, our guest on this edition of UWM Today as we take a look at the challenges and the huge problems that we face as a result of redlining here in our community and in other parts of the country. Well, that's all for this week's program. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care and stay healthy, everybody. I'm Tom Mujak.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujak, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.